Freezing on Impact with Melanie Chandra, Mel Earfan, Kat Maguire, Tim O'Brien, Mark Perver and Christina Smith. The Jobcast, February 2012 Extra Edition. Hello and welcome to the Jobcast. Joining me in the studio today are Kat and Mark. Hi guys.
Hello.
Hi.
And you may be wondering about our witty comment, freezing on impact, and this is due to some freezing rain that was scheduled to happen yesterday, which didn't actually appear.
No, it was all very dramatic. We all thought we'd be stranded in the building, but yeah, we're okay. I slipped a bit on the train station, but that was about the height of the danger there, I think.
It sounded really apocalyptic, cause this rain was supposed to just freeze like some kind of superhero from a film as soon as it hit the ground. But actually, I think all the rain in Manchester is pretty freezing and we're actually quite used to it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In the show this time, we talk to Dr. Danielle Fenech from UCL and Dr. Tim O'Brien answers your astronomical questions. But first, before all of that, we have Mel talking to Dr. Anthony Holloway in this month's Job Bite.
So, welcome to our second ever Job Bite. And today we're going to be talking to Ant Holloway, who's in charge of IT here at Jodrell Bank. So, Ant, I guess there's loads and loads of tasks that you'd be required for, but what do you generally do on a day-to-day basis?
Well, thanks for having me on. Most of the time, we're solving people's problems that they have with the computer systems. As you can imagine, we've got a lot of kit for sort of processing all the data that's coming in off the telescopes. Mm-hmm. And so it's helping people make use of the systems to analyse their data.
And but you actually did your PhD in something astronomy, something astrophysics based.
Yeah, right? I was sort of an optical astronomer. So Manchester used to have a separate optical astronomy group, and I did my PhD with John Meeburn studying active galaxies and planetary nebulae, things like that, going out to optical telescopes. And then I was working after my PhD, carried on as a postdoc for a bit, and our system manager at the time left. And so I sort of thought, it was a different sort of thing. I'd been interested in computers as well as astronomy. So it was a way of sort of combining the two interests together. So, and that was about 12 years ago.
So we have some stuff here at Jodrell that's pretty high maintenance. And I sort of mean the supercomputers and the clusters. Can you tell us a bit about that? Because they're pretty temperamental.
So some of the groups, Pulsar group is the classic, they process a lot of data searching for new pulsars, and to do that work involves a lot of number crunching. They're sort of searching for these pulsing signals through what sounds like noise, so to sort of get through that data needs a lot of compute power, so they've got sort of two of the large clusters that we have at Jodrell.
And what about the new project that we're starting here, the eMALEN project? Does that occupy a lot of your time currently, or do you not have to? Are you all set up for that already?
eMERLIN, so the big effort is obviously has been with the front end. So with eMERLIN replacing the microwave data links with fibre optics, that's led to a huge increase in the amount of data coming back. And the engineers have had to develop new instruments to sort of process that data and transmit the data and then process it. So that was there's a custom bit of kit called the correlator that does that work. And that's been developed with our partners around the world. We're now getting to the point where I get involved, which is where we have to do something with the data that's coming off the telescopes and store it and sort of analyse it. And actually people are starting to look at producing the images. So we're looking at the minute of sort of putting in place some of the big systems required to process and store all that data.
So obviously we've just mentioned eMERLIN. Could you just clarify to those who aren't familiar, what is eMERLIN actually?
Right, so eMERLIN is the upgrade of what we used to call the Merlin Network, which is a set of telescopes that Jodrell Bank operates that are spread across the UK. And in the Merlin form of it, the data was sent back over microwave links, bringing all the data back to Jodrell Bank, combining together to produce images as if you had a radio telescope that was as big as the distance from Jodrell to Cambridge. So that lets you see much more detail in the images, in the objects that we're studying. eMERLIN is our upgrade, where we've replaced those microwave links with fibre optic links. And so we can put, just like sort of everybody's getting their broadband upgraded at the minute, we've already done this with eMERLIN, and so we can bring far more data back to Jodrell, and putting more data in from the telescopes means we can get sort of a deeper image. We can see sort of fainter objects in the observations that we're making with the same telescopes, but now we get to see more, just because we can bring more data back.
You must have quite a good grasp of sort of all the projects that go on around here, because, I mean, if someone has a problem, they come to you and they're like, oh, this program's not working, and I can't do this, and you must get to know what they're trying to do, what the various programs they need are, and how, you know.
Yeah, we're sort of probably one of the IT, probably one of the few groups that people in the observatory do get to see all the different projects that are going on, because everything pretty much needs IT, from, you know, outreach activity right the way through to, I mean, all the data processing, and then sort of housekeeping functions, keeping a track of who's here and who's left and all this sort of stuff. So yeah, you do get a good idea of what's going on, which obviously helps when somebody comes on with a new project and says, right, we want to do this. Somebody else has probably already addressed that area before, so you can sort of point them in the right direction.
And okay, so you've got a hobby in photography, I believe, and that also kind of links in with what you do, because I've seen pictures on our web that have been taken sort of by you. So do you do anything for the website, or do you just take the pictures? Because most pictures I see are from you.
yeah, it sort of seems to be a tradition of John from in the past did actually have an official photographer when they had to produce photographic images to put into journal papers. But then obviously that sort of thing's all gone by the way now. It's all done electronically. So people there's obviously quite a few people at Jodra are keen photographers outside of work. Mm-hmm. So yeah, on the opportunities where there's a good sunset or something going on, then there's a few of us are out there with cameras getting the shots. Yeah, sort of. It doesn't matter how many times you take a picture of it. You can always take another picture of the telescopes. Very photogenic. But yeah, so some of that obviously goes onto the website, and there's a whole bunch of pictures we've got on the web, covering sort of things like the telescopes and also the instruments and some of the images and data as well. Yeah, and then we sort of edit all sorts of bits and pieces. We've got the webcams, of course, as well, that sat there. So if anyone wants to see what the telescopes are doing right now, you can go and have a look and see where the telescopes are pointing.
And do you still have to go back up to Jodrell much since we moved into Manchester? Do you return there often?
Yeah. They're about usually sort of one day a week. Because obviously, whilst a lot of the academic activities are in Manchester, all the observing is being done at Jodrell. So, as you say, E-Merlin, pulsars, they've all got systems that are sort of hooked into the telescopes, and often it makes a lot of sense to process the data there as it's coming off the telescope. Obviously, one of the issues we have is shielding those computers, that we don't want the electronics and things in the computers getting picked up by the telescopes and sort of contaminating the signals we're trying to look for. We know the classic story of the Lovell can pick up a mobile phone on Mars, which is what we're trying to do when the Beagle probe landed or didn't land or whatever. So with some of these large compute cluster things, we do have to put them into shielded cabinets or in
I was
case...
going to say, are they actually locked up like the microwaves there, like locked in Faraday cages?
So the big pulsar computer there is all in a Faraday cage, and the other sort of big facility is the E-Merlin correlator room. So we have a fully shielded, you know, big probably sort of 4x5 meter cube of solid steel that contains the E-Merlin systems. So that again, we don't want to use the telescopes to observe our own building. There's sort of a lot of effort goes in from the technical staff at Jodrell into sort of how to design these shielded rooms.
So when I was talking about the fairly temperamental computers we have, I think I meant more in terms of the coma cluster and our supercomputers, and that they're very specific. The temperature they have to be kept up at as well, right?
Yes, I mean, they have to be in air-conditioned rooms. And obviously, that causes a challenge, particularly at Jodrell, where we want a rack that stops signals getting out, but we want to get the air in. And so we have to have racks that have honeycomb filters on, which sort of let the air get through, but the fine grid sort of stops the radio waves from escaping. It does also make the room look quite attractive when you've got all the LEDs blinking and flashing, and you see them through all these sort of grids sort of reflecting the light around. But yes, essentially
quite high maintenance.
Yeah.
If you get them in the right condition, they're fine. You can.
Yeah, if you get overheating, then yeah, you've got a problem. Okay. But yeah, essentially, we buy sort of rack mounted PCs, which can then be sort of stacked up in these racks. But they're using standard sort of PC components. It's Intel processors and hard disks and all the rest. We use the Linux operating system. So that's one of the big things that's just slightly different maybe from most people's experience of computing is that we don't use Windows for processing this data, because you want to, or Linux operating system is very good at enabling you to manage a large number of computers very easily from sort of one head machine. You can control the whole cluster. And also it makes it easier for people to process their data. They submit jobs onto a queue and then it finds spare computers to go and run those programs on.
It manages itself. It time sort of manages itself, or every request gets put towards you, and then you allocate people time, or is it simply first come first serve, sit in the back of the computer line?
It uses what's something called a fair shares algorithm. So the idea is that if, say, one person's been using the cluster intensively for a few days, and then you come along with your job, even if they've got jobs still waiting to run, it'll go, well, okay, they've had their fair share for the last few days. Right, we'll pick this other person's job to run now because let everybody have a go. And still, you can get some situations where people work out the rules and they try and sort of, work out how best to load the system so that their jobs get the highest priority, but we should put a stop to that.
I was going to say, you could expect no less from scientists, right? Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming to speak to us, and it's very cool.
No problem. Cheers.
Thanks for that, Mel. Next, Melanie speaks to Dr. Danielle Fenech about starburst galaxies.
Hi, I'm here today with Dr. Danielle Fenech. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, Melanie.
How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
So, Danielle works on the starburst galaxy M82. Can you tell us more about this galaxy? What's special about it?
Okay, M82 is actually a nearby starburst galaxy, the closest to us in the Northern Hemisphere. And it's a starburst because it's currently undergoing active star formation, and it has a much higher star formation rate, so it's producing stars at a much higher rate than our own galaxy does. And that means we get to study a lot about the processes of star formation, and in particular for me, the end points of star formation when stars reach the ends of their existence and explode as supernovae and form supernova remnants, so the remains of a supernova explosion.
And what's so interesting about studying supernova remnants?
Well, they tell you about the processes of star formation in the galaxy. They tell you about the effects of star formation on the galaxy, and you can use them to probe the interstellar medium within the galaxy itself.
What do you mean by probe the interstellar medium?
You can study what kind of environment the interstellar medium is, so what kind of gas pressures and densities there are. And in M82 in particular, it's very interesting because the level of star formation and the level of and the numbers of supernova explosions are so high that they actually cause a mass ejection of gas out of the galaxy itself in what's called superwind.
And?
Well, that's particularly interesting because then you start to understand how a high active star formation region can produce effects that not only change the environment within a galaxy, but dump material out of a galaxy into the intergalactic medium and affect the galaxy clusters and nearby galaxies to it.
So those supernova explosion, it's kind of the way we spread new material or spread new molecules in the universe, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We would not be here without the fact that stars before our sun, before, in fact, the ones we're now studying, had not gone through their lives and exploded as supernovae and become supernova remnants. That is the only way you get things like carbon, which is what we're made from, out into the wider universe. We would not be here if it were not for exploding stars.
You talk about the life of a star. Can you give us the steps of the life of a star from birth to, like, how long is it and what are the different steps in the evolution of a star?
Okay, well, the stars that we see in M82 are slightly different from our own sun in that they are much more massive. To begin with, they're typically 8 to 10 solar mass stars and can be up to several tens of solar mass stars. And that means that their evolution is slightly different from our sun. But the evolution of any star is dictated by the nuclear fusion process, and it starts off with mostly hydrogen coalesced into forming the star, which eventually under its own gravitational collapse will ignite and start to produce radiation. That reaches an equilibrium and you end up with, in a situation not dissimilar to our sun, the star existing for a certain period of time, fusing hydrogen and emitting radiation. Once all of the hydrogen is used up in that way, it actually produces helium, and the star will collapse further under its own gravitational pull and start to use the helium to in the nuclear fusion to produce more radiation. A star, a massive star like those in M82, will go through that process, fusing higher and higher mass elements until it reaches a point where it can no longer sustain its own gravitational pull by the fusion process. That's the point at which it collapses in on itself and actually rebounds off of the central dense core, which is what the supernova explosion is.
That point of explosion, is it the same for all stars?
Well, yes and no. It will go through the nuclear fusion process the same for massive stars. As I said, the sun's a lower mass star and will actually have a slightly different process. But ultimately, it will depend on how massive the star was to begin with. So an 8 solar mass star is probably going to live a little bit longer and will go through the process slower than something like 100 solar mass star, for example.
So you observe those supernova remnants in radio, right? Why radio?
Radio specifically because M82, like our own galaxy, in fact, has a large amount of gas and dust. And with a particularly high star formation rate, it produces a lot of gas and dust. And the main starburst activity in M82 is right in the centre of the galaxy. And because of the obscuration that optical wavelengths, for example, suffer because of the gas and dust, they just can't see into the centre of the galaxy. Whereas with the radio, we can see right through it, and we can literally see right into the centre at very high resolutions and pick out individual supernova remnants that are just completely obscured in the optical.
Is there any other wavelengths that's interesting to study supernova remnants?
In M82, certainly in general, yes. I mean, there's activity that's observable and at all wavelengths, really, and different wavelengths can tell you different things about which particular region you're studying in terms of a supernova remnant. It's difficult to do, as I said, in M82 because of the obscuration and because it's not on our doorstep. It's not the same as observing supernova remnants in our own galaxy. But you can equally well with infrared observations and submillimeter observations start to resolve individual supernova remnants in the center of the galaxy.
I have a question about the different starburst galaxies in general. You said that you can infer the rate of star formation. Is the star formation, what is it triggered by? Is it just from a merger, or is there other way to trigger star formation?
Generally, there are a few ways that you can trigger a star formation. In particular, for M82, it's having a tidal interaction with another galaxy. It's part of a group which is known as the M81, M82 group of galaxies. And M82 and M81 have passed particularly close by on galactic scales, or intergalactic scales, in fact. And in the same way that the moon has a tidal effect on the Earth, the gas is being moved around and tidally moved by the interaction with M81 in terms of M82. Other than that, there are more distant starburst galaxies, such as ARC-220, that have a massive merger. So you've literally had the situation of two galaxies running right into each other. Now, that obviously has a very turbulent effect on the gas and in the galaxy, and so can trigger a lot of star formation as well. Galaxies that have supermassive black holes at their center can also trigger star formation near the actual nucleus, near the black hole, as a function of the activity of the black hole taking in and accreting the gas from the rest of the galaxy as well.
What determines how much starburst there will be in a galaxy? Is it the size of the galaxy? Is it the amount of gas? Or is there anything in particular?
Well, it's sort of both, in that the larger a galaxy, typically the more gas it has. But the level of starburst, or at least the extent of a starburst, is very much dictated by how much gas is available. I mean, if you have a finite amount of gas in any given galaxy, you can only sustain a starburst for as long as there is gas to produce stars with.
So when you look at a starburst galaxy with a radio telescope, what you'll see is all the supernova remnant. Is that the only thing you use to determine the star formation in this galaxy?
Actually, no. When you look at M82 in particular, for example, but it's the same for any starburst galaxy, in the radio specifically, you pick out not only the individual supernova remnants, but also regions of ionized gas. And they are themselves a obvious identifier of current star formation. They are regions produced from stars ionizing their surrounding medium, and you can pick those out in the radio as well.
What would be, ideally for you, the one thing you'd like to see in M82 that would answer all your questions?
Answer all of my questions. That's a difficult one. Although, in particular, one of the sources that I've been looking at in M82, and people before me have as well, and I'm sure people after me will too, is a particular source, 41.95 plus 57.5. Very uninteresting name, but it's a phenomenally interesting object. It, up until the 1960s, dominated the emission, the radio emission of M82 as a whole, and has since been decaying at around a rate of 8.5% a year. So is about the same luminosity as many of the other sources now, but it doesn't look like a normal supernova remnant as we'd expect it to, which seems to be bipolar and not shell-like, which is what you'd expect from a uniform explosion. And we currently have no complete explanation for what that source could be. It's possibly been associated with a nearby gamma ray burst. If you extrapolate the information we have back to the time that you'd expect it to have exploded, if it is a gamma ray burst associated with a supernova event, then it would have been much brighter than any known supernova explosion in M82 on the level of a gamma ray burst, but it would have to still have had an unusual for a gamma ray burst event. And in terms of detecting those in the nearby universe, well, there aren't any. They're all very high redshift, very distant events. So it's mostly speculation at the moment in terms of what that actually is, but it's a very unusual source and a very interesting source.
That sounds really cool. So gamma ray burst, is that the only explanation, the only thing you could think of for this weird source?
Well, I mean, no, there are other possibilities that it just happens to be an unusual supernova event, in that it's quite a normal, possibly in the ranges of supernova events, and it's just that the way that we observe it and the way it seems to us and the information that we can actually get from it, we don't have a complete picture. I mean, there is another supernova remnant, in fact, in another nearby galaxy that's also shown some similar characteristics to this particular source in M82. And actually, what that has turned out to be is a particularly bright core remain. So, in fact, they think it's possibly a pulsar or a black hole at the center of the supernova remnant that's become observable. And so it's having an unusual effect in terms of how we actually see the source. Now, it's expected for most of the supernova remnants that you will get that kind of core remained once it's thrown off the outer shells from the original star, that you will actually end up with some form of neutron star or black hole at the centre. But it's not often detected, and certainly not in galaxies outside of our own. I mean, obviously, there's some reasonably famous supernova remnants within the galaxy where this is already observed. But that is... This SN1986J is the supernova remnant, the supernova event that this has been associated with. But the characteristics of that particular supernova remnant don't completely match up with the one in M82. I mean, again, it shows some very similar characteristics, but it doesn't give us the whole explanation just yet.
So what kind of information would you need to get a definite answer?
We'd need... certainly more detailed monitoring of its evolution to try and study what's going on in terms of its decay and luminosity and any evolution structurally in terms of whether or not it's expanding, which is what you expect a supernova remnant to do, because obviously it was an explosion, it threw off the material outward, you expect it to keep going. And if that's not the case, why it would have slowed down, and why such a massive decay that is in fact still continuing, most of the other supernova remnants, certainly the younger ones in M82 even now, have reached a reasonably stable part of their evolution in terms of their luminosity, whereas this source hasn't. Also, we need higher resolution and better fidelity images to be able to pick out any... and to see if there is actually any radio emission other than just the bipolar structure that we're seeing. So, for example, if there is a faint pulsar or black hole in the centre of it, or if, in fact, it does have a complete shell and we're only being able to pick out what is the more prominent bipolar emission. More observations is always the answer.
Wow, M82 sounds like a really cool galaxy to study.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you very much, Danielle.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for that, Melanie. And now we come to the part of the show where we fit in all those other things that we couldn't fit in anywhere else, the odds and ends. This year's UK-Germany National Astronomy Meeting is actually being held in Manchester this year. And as part of this, there's going to be some public lectures being held. And it's free to go to these lectures, but you do have to book in advance. They're going to be aimed at general public knowledge, and even people who are sort of later school years will be able to attend and understand sort of what's going on. Got some pretty interesting lectures going on, including one on the structure of the universe and one on the Juno mission to Jupiter. So that should be pretty awesome to attend.
Sounds good. It's going to be a good conference, I think.
Yeah, it should be.
It's always quite exciting because the National Astronomy Meeting, or NAM, is where all of the UK astronomers get together, and in this case also some from Germany, and it's good that we're doing a lot of outreach events around it, and having it here in Manchester it's going to be a bit manic for everybody, but it should be quite exciting.
Yeah, it should be really exciting. There's also, in some of the plenary lectures that are sort of part of the conference, there are going to be some free tickets for school teachers and members of local astronomical societies. They can get hold of some tickets for that. We'll link to the website where you can find out how to book these on the show notes. So if you want to go along, check that out.
I'm particularly looking forward to the football tournament as well.
Yeah, you're going to take on Germany and Scotland and Northern Ireland, I believe.
That's right. All these institutions have entered teams to the five-a-side, although actually the players will all be very international because all those institutions have people from all over the world in them. But it should be fun. Excitingly, there are now two more moons of Jupiter since we presented the last show. Actually, they're not really new, but they've just been discovered, or rather they've just been announced, as the observations from which they were discovered were made at the Las Campanas Observatory in Chile in September. They're rather small moons. Each of them is only about a kilometre wide, which explains why they hadn't been observed before. So they're a bit dim and a bit distant as well from Jupiter. So that brings the number of moons now known to orbit Jupiter up to 66. And the interesting thing about these ones is that in common with 50 other of the Jovian moons, I had no idea about this before, they actually orbit retrograde, which means essentially backwards, or in the opposite sense to the planet Jupiter's rotation and the direction of its orbit around the Sun. And that's a bit strange, because during the formation of the solar system, you pretty much expect most things to be rotating the same direction, orbiting, rotating on their axes, whichever. And so these were probably captured during the early solar system, but after Jupiter actually formed, probably captured them. And there's a whole swarm of them, 52 known, and they think there might be about 100 of them in that swarm.
So do they all get their own individual names then?
They do, apparently, or they will. Again, didn't know this. By established convention, it says satellites in the Jovian system are named after lovers and descendants of the Roman god Jupiter or the Greek god Zeus, who's his counterpart.
That's a lot of lovers and descendants.
That's a lot of lovers. Very appropriate, as we've just had Valentine's Day.
Yes. Well, I believe Jupiter was rather polyamorous. And, he's got 100 or so retrograde lovers and descendants, apparently.
I hope they don't run out.
These two take 580 and 726 days, respectively, to complete their orbits. They're actually quite far away as well. Certainly a good bit further away than the four biggest moons of Jupiter that you normally see when you look up there with a telescope. So don't necessarily expect to see them, but do expect even more Jovian moons to be discovered in the near future. And apparently after they've been observed for a year, someone gets to name them after a mythological person or...
That'd be a good job to have. I wonder how they decide.
I was just going to say, I'd quite like to be the person to name the moons of Jupiter.
I could do that. Okay, so now on to something slightly less serious. As we were all watching Stargazing Live, we were, weren't we?
Yeah, I was.
You might remember them talking about a really interesting and special wine that is infused with a 4.5 billion year old meteorite. And I was quite interested in this, so I did a bit more research because I wanted to find out more about it. Apparently, it's made by an astronomy and wine enthusiast called Ian Hutchin, who's originally from Norwich but now runs both a vineyard and an astronomy centre in Chile. And he decided he wanted to do something to combine his two passions, and so this was the result.
What a great combination.
Amazing combination, astronomy and wine. We've not tried that before, have we?
And at 4.5 billion years old, that is a mature wine, to say the least.
It's a very mature wine. I believe it was only in the wine for 12 months, but apparently gives it a lively taste, so those 4.5 billion years.
I have to say, I missed all this because I was in Wales doing some actual live stargazing under a very dark sky, but I understand from Libby that while she was in the Stargazing Live studio, she actually drank some of this wine.
Oh, I'm sorry I missed out on that. We'll have to find out off Libby what it tastes like, but I'm looking forward to getting some for the next Jodrell Bank Christmas party. You're going to Chile soon, aren't you?
Yeah, sometime in May, hopefully.
Yeah, bring some back.
You required by duty, I think, to go and get some of this wine for us.
Future wine tasters may talk about notes of meteorite in their wine. So now, on a more serious note, if anyone's missing him since the end of Stargazing Live, here is Dr. Tim O'Brien answering your astronomical questions.
The first question this month is from Hayley, and she wrote in to say, I live on the Wirral, and today around 3 p.m. the sun appeared to have a strip of colour to its side. It was like a mini rainbow, but not as colourful. Also, it seemed to reflect, causing it to look like there were two suns in the sky. What would cause this?
All right, yeah, so this is a phenomenon that we've seen a few times recently that I think you get it really when you've got some nice cold weather and some clear skies as well. And it's actually caused by ice crystals in the upper atmosphere. And the rather bizarre name given to it is sun dogs.
Sun dogs?
I actually have no idea why it's called sun dogs. But you basically see these things either side of the sun often. And Hayley talks about seeing one on one side of the sun, but quite often you'd see them sort of symmetrically placed either side. Or sometimes, that's usually when the sun's low down. If the sun's higher up, you can sometimes get a full ring around the sun. That's called a halo. And basically what happens is there's ice crystals in the upper atmosphere, and the hexagonal ice crystals that form. And as the sunlight passes through these crystals, it's actually deflected. It's refracted through the face of the crystal. So it goes in through one side of the crystal. It comes out through a face on the opposite side of this hexagonal crystal. And it turns out that there's lots of... So it's basically a refraction effect, just like you get with water droplets that form a rainbow. And so you get this sort of little mini rainbow effect either side, which is why you could see that sort of coloured fringing as the light split up into the different colours. And you actually get it, it actually appears at an exact angle of 22 degrees away from the sun. So if you sort of point at the sun and then point at one of these sun dogs, the angle will be 22 degrees, and it's because of the angle of refraction through the faces of this hexagonal crystal that you get a minimum deflection of light of 22 degrees. So quite interesting things to study.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, so you do spot them if you keep an eye out. I think if you see these, sometimes you see these sort of fringing colours around the moon or the sun sometimes that are rather closer than that, and I think those are not the ice crystals, but they're more like a sort of water droplet effect from the atmosphere. But these sun dogs are these hexagonal ice crystals.
Awesome. I'll definitely be keeping a lookout for those. Yeah. Our next question is from Patrick, who asks, what is the most interesting thing you can find on the other side of planets that you wouldn't normally be able to see in the night sky?
Ah, okay. So, an interesting question. I think most planets, you know, planets basically rotate typically. So, for example, if you pick Jupiter and you looked at Jupiter through a small telescope, you might be lucky enough to see the Great Red Spot, which is this big sort of storm in the atmosphere of Jupiter. But because Jupiter rotates, sometimes the Great Red Spot will be on the far side of Jupiter, and you just have to wait until it comes around the front side. I mean, even the Sun actually rotates about once every 28 days. So if we're looking at things like sunspots or active regions and these sort of flares or prominences, you actually see them sort of come into view from the far side of the sun and then disappear again around the other side sort of 2 weeks later. Which is why we've got these spacecraft called Stereo, where there's these two spacecraft headed off around the sun basically, so that we're able to now see all sides of the sun. We've basically got it surrounded with Stereo, so we can see the far side as well as near side. But I think probably the most interesting object, which is not technically a planet, but our moon, is quite interesting to think about what you can see from one side or the other side, because for the moon, we're actually tidally locked, which means that the sort of gravitational pull between the Earth and the moon has locked it in orbit, so that the rotation period for the moon is the same length of time as it takes for it to orbit the Earth, 28 days. So basically it stays with one face pointing towards us all the time, which means that we only ever get to see the near side. And the far side was unknown until we first sent a spacecraft out there to travel beyond the moon and have a look. And actually that was done by the Russians in October of 1959. It was a spacecraft called Luna 3. And it was tracked by Jodrell Bank. So at that time the Russians, there wasn't very much around for people to track these early spacecraft. So the Lovell telescope at Jodrell was quite important in that regard. And the Russians actually used to fax all the details of the spacecraft to Jodrell, to Bernard Lovell at Jodrell. They used to sort of tell him when they were launching it, what the frequencies were they were going to be transmitting on and so on, just so that he could actually listen in and partly confirm that they were really doing what they said they were doing. So we actually did track Luna 3 as it headed round to the far side of the moon, and it took photographs and sent those photographs back to Earth. They actually took real photographs, and they actually had to be developed automatically on the spacecraft.
Oh wow,
on the spacecraft, yeah. And then when they got the developed photograph, there was a little scanning system that scanned the photograph in and then turned that into a radio signal and sent it back to Earth. So although I think, I'll put a link to the information on our website about this, but it seems that we did pick up some of those photographic signals that were sent, but we didn't actually turn them into photos because, well, either it wasn't the actual photo, it was a test signal, or we didn't actually pick them up at the time the actual photos were sent. But certainly the Russians were the first to produce these photos of the far side of the moon, and it looks very different. It's really heavily cratered compared to the near side. The near side's got all these Maria, these seas of tranquility and so on. which we think are just sort of lava plains. And the far side doesn't really look like that. So that's either something to do with it being perhaps more heavily impacted because it's facing away from the Earth, maybe. Or a recent idea is that actually there were two moons originally in orbit around the Earth, and one of them collided with the main moon, if you like, and that collision caused the surfaces of our moon to be rather different from one side to the other. So that's still something that we're thinking about. And these NASA Grail spacecraft, which have been renamed Grail A and B, which I think were renamed Ebb and Flow recently, which is quite a nice
Ebb and Flow,
which is quite good because they're being producing the tides, you see, so it's quite a nice link there. They're one of the things they're interested in is studying the interior of the moon by its gravity as they orbit the moon, and maybe that will help us understand why the moon's far side looks so different to its near side.
Oh, brilliant. That should be really, really interesting.
Yeah, we'll have to look out for that as the results come through.
Now we have a message from Alexandra in Poland, who's written in to say, what would happen to the Earth in the absence of the Sun? I mean, where would Earth fall to? In the absence of gravity, would the Earth fall to infinity?
So I guess it's what would happen if the Sun suddenly disappeared.
Yeah.
So apart from it getting very cold and very dark and not being very comfortable, what would happen is the Earth would fly off, because the Earth is sort of orbiting the Sun currently, so it's the... Imagine the Earth doesn't fall directly into the Sun because it's actually moving sideways. So in a sense, the Earth is falling towards the Sun, but it keeps missing it. Sort of falls around and around and around the Sun. So if you suddenly manage to take away the Sun and therefore lose the gravitational pull of the Sun on the Earth would sort of carry on moving in the direction it happens to be moving in. That doesn't mean that it will sort of head off to infinity, because the Earth is actually still bound to the Milky Way. It's the gravity of the whole of the galaxy, if you like, would keep the Earth bound to the Milky Way. So I think you wouldn't head off into infinity, you know, directly, but we would sort of continue to travel around the Milky Way. And I guess one thing is worth thinking about: how fast might all this be happening? The orbital speed of the Earth is about 30 kilometers a second. So we're moving now at about 30 kilometres a second as we travel around the Sun. And if you think how long that would take you to get anywhere, if we happen to have been travelling in the direction of the nearest star, it would take over 40,000 years for the Earth to get there. So we might travel head off into space, but we wouldn't be going anywhere particularly fast. So I think that probably answers Alexander's question.
Yeah, definitely. We have a question from Christoph, and he says, why does the method of gravitational lensing work if normal matter, which is used in this method as I understand, only makes up 5% of all mass in the universe? Is dark matter just too dispersed to interfere with this process?
Right, well, I mean, gravitational lensing, just to explain what that is, first of all, it's basically an effect caused by the curvature of space-time, which is something that Einstein suggested as part of his general theory of relativity. So objects with mass effectively change the geometry of space-time, they curve space-time. And then light, which travels on the shortest path through space-time, is actually effectively appears to bend around massive objects. So in gravitational lensing, what you imagine is you imagine us sort of sitting here and looking out into space at a distant object. And the first object for which this effect was seen was a quasar. And it was actually seen by a group of astronomers at Jodrell Bank back in the late 1970s. So if you looked at this distant quasar, what happens is the light from that quasar is actually bent around an object between us and the quasar. And for this first one, it's called the double quasar because the light was split and effectively formed two images of the same quasar off in distant space. Now, in fact, the question here is, the confusion is that actually, yes, normal matter can cause gravitational lensing. But dark matter also causes gravitational lensing because dark matter still has mass. In fact, that's how we know it's there, is because of its gravitational effect. So although it doesn't produce any light, and hence the name dark matter, it does have gravity, and therefore it does contribute to gravitational lensing. And actually, because there's five times as much dark matter, we think, as normal matter, if you want to call it that, the normal stuff around us that we're made of, because there's five times more dark matter than normal matter, actually, its effects dominate in gravitational lensing studies. So gravitational lensing is one of the best ways we have of studying dark matter, and we have to certainly take into account its effects when we're looking at the sort of distortion of the images of galaxies in clusters and so on, caused by the dark matter of intervening clusters or intervening galaxies.
Fantastic. And that's all the questions that we have for this month. But please send in any of your questions that you want answered via the webpage at www.jodcast.net.
Thanks for that, Tim. Now on to the feedback.
We've had 3 postcards since the last episode.
That's a lot of postcards. Makes us happy.
Did I get one?
They're all addressed to the Jodcast, so I think they're all for all of us. We can share them out. They've come from all over the place. We got one from Mike Kelly, who was on holiday in New Zealand, and he went to the Mount John Observatory, where we had an audio tour from in an early episode of the Jodcast, yonks ago. He said it was the darkest skies ever seen, and as well as seeing the Milky Way, he saw both the large and small Magellanic Cloud clearly, which are satellite dwarf galaxies of the Milky Way. I've seen the large Magellanic Cloud once. You can't see it from Manchester, you have to be quite southerly to see it, but it's amazing to see, because you really think maybe it is just a cloud, this fuzzy thing, and then you think, nope, it's this clear sky, and it's actually another galaxy.
I'd quite like to see the large Magellanic Cloud.
And then from an even warmer location, we had a postcard from the Bahamas, from Anna and Sam. And they said, love listening to the show on the beach. It's just rubbing it in. Bet they had no freezing rain. But they did see a turtle, they said, which was ace. And also, I really like the front of the postcard, because it says, yum yum, send more tourists.
I hope they survive their trip.
I'm sure that you don't get savaged by a turtle. It has a picture of a shark on it. And to complete the set, we also had a postcard from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, so that's fabulous. Thank you.
We also had an email from Andrew Horner, who has recently discovered the Jodcast after doing a bit of research after watching Stargazing Live. It's always nice to get new listeners. Apparently, at the moment, he's catching up on some past editions, and he's particularly enjoying the Ask an Astronomer series. So welcome, Andrew. I hope you stay with us.
Yeah, welcome, Andrew, and welcome to any other new listeners that are out there as well.
I love it when people go and listen to past editions and decide they're going to plough through the entire archive, because that is a mission, but a very commendable one.
There's a lot of dedication to the cause there. And on Facebook, we've had a message from Paul Walsh, who says he's looking forward to listening later. I reckon if there's a Stargazing Live next year, they should do a bit on how the Jodcast is put together.
I think that's best left to the imagination.
I'd like to see them fit a filming crew into our little studio here.
We have had bits of foam falling off the wall today as well, which is always nice when you're trying to record. No, in all seriousness, we're very professional.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And thanks to everybody on Twitter for all the tweets about the Jodcast and the latest Jodcast episodes. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can do so via the website at www.jodcast.net.
On the forum at forum.jodcast.net.
On Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast.
On Facebook at facebook.com/jodcast.
On YouTube at youtube.com/jodcast.
And on Flickr at flickr.com/groups/jodcast.
And don't forget that you can also send us post, and the address is on the website. So, all that's left to say is thanks to Dr. Danielle Fennec for the interview. Thanks to Dr. Anthony Holloway for the Jod Bite. The editors were Dan Thornton, Tim O'Brien, and Christina Smith. The producer was Christina Smith. Until next time, Jod on!